Hello and welcome back to Angel Insights, the show that delves inside the world of early stage investing to reveal the tips, tactics and strategies of some of today's leading angel investors, brought to you by Syndicate Room. And joining me today, I'm delighted to welcome Nick Lyth. Now, Nick is a founder at the Green Angel Syndicate, the only angel investment syndicate specializing in investments to benefit the green economy. And as for Nick, prior to Green Angels, he spent over 10 years building up a new applied research institute in the eco and environmental arena with the international state to attract innovation to its door. He's also contributed to forums advising the Scottish Government, the Northern Irish Government, and the European Parliament in Brussels. And if you love the show today with Nick and want to see more from Syndicate Room, then you can head to the site, syndicateroom.com, where you can find a whole host more resources, podcast episodes, and articles. However, it's now time for me to hand the mic over to the main man, Nick Lyth, founder at Green Angels Syndicate. So talk to me, Nick. It's such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining me.
It's a great pleasure, Harry.
Now, I'd love to start today, Nick, by hearing how you made your way into the world of early stage investing and what your real entry point was.
Well, I'm a very unusual person to find in the investment sector. I've spent my life elsewhere, and so I was completely new to investment when I set up Green Angel Syndicate 3 years ago. And the reason why I did it, and the point of entry, as you call it, was because I'd been working in resource use innovations for the previous 10 years, and I'd been seeing a lot of really very interesting technology innovations, which represented exciting opportunities that the public sector that I was working with had no idea how to exploit. And I kept seeing these going to waste, and that pained me considerably for a variety of reasons, not least of which is that it's important that technology innovations in resource use are brought forward and accelerated in order to help us as a global community. But even more, I was watching what I considered to be really good business opportunities going to waste. And so I set up the Angel Syndicate in order to create the means by which they could be exploited. But because of my complete lack of background or education in the sector, it's been very much like reinventing the wheel, you know. I've been learning things that people who've been doing this all their lives would take for granted. And they've come as interesting, exciting, and sometimes not so pleasant shock to me. So it's been a strange course.
I've got several points to dig into on that. One of them is I've spent actually a lot of time in the renewable energy space, and I've been surprised by the lack of kind of public investment interest in it. And I'm wondering why you think, particularly maybe the early stage angel and VC market, isn't so intertwined with the energy and renewable energy space.
Well, renewable energy has been a political football, and I would blame entirely successive governments. That is perhaps a little bit unfair, but what happened is that when particularly the climate change agenda, but before that the sustainable development agenda, started to grind away, it became a little bit of a political bandwagon, and consequently they created all sorts of different incentives and subsidies to develop renewable energy, and those had bewildering and very unsatisfactory commercial effects on the market. In the last 5 years, here in the UK, the Conservative administration has been briefing against renewable energy, and the enormously powerful Treasury run by George Osborne completely drowned out the voice of the minnow of the Department of Energy and Climate Change, which no longer exists now, George Osborne was able to switch the financial levers off so that the subsidies for solar and wind in particular were reduced and gradually have been removed. And the consequence of that is that a lot of businesses in those sectors have gone bust. So it's been a troubled sector. And in fact, in terms of investment, we steer clear of renewable energy itself. The energy sectors we're interested in are really all about energy efficiency, energy storage technologies, energy distribution technologies, energy management technologies, which are really much more exciting.
So in terms of the onboarding process for you, in terms of learning, and when you entered the investing game, what were the big shocks and learning curves for you on entering the industry, and how did you react to them?
I'll tell you the biggest shock, which is a sign of my naivety, and in some senses it's inexcusable, because I'm long in the tooth and should have known better. I rather bought into the accepted wisdom that what you're investing in is the team, and if you've got a reasonable technology and reasonable intellectual property and a brilliant team, you'll have a successful business. Whereas if you've got brilliant technology and great IP, but a second-rate team, the business will fail. And I thought that was axiomatic. And consequently, in our early investments, and I should stress, we're only so far invested in six different companies. It's still a very small portfolio. But in our first investment, I very much took the attitude that I would arrange the investment, put the investment in, and then step back and not require any form of board position or observer rights or anything like that. I would just ask the management to report back to us every 6 months or more frequently if they could, and I would report back to the investors what was going on. Relatively quickly, maybe a year to 18 months, started to realize that the first of them wasn't going quite as well as we had wished, and that from a distance I could see what was not quite right. And so I started trying to talk to them about it. But of course, they didn't want to listen to me. I wasn't on the board. I wasn't an observer. I had no role. So why should they listen to somebody who had nothing to do with their company other than being a silent investor? Really, since that learning, we've insisted that we at the very least have observer rights on every investment that we make. But more commonly, we are actually on the board. And that we have a role, it's generally me, a role that we actually use to contribute to the business itself and help them fill in their skills gaps.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. In terms of kind of being on the board and being an observer, what do you think makes a great board member? You've seen now as an observer, I'm sure, many board meetings. What do you think makes a great board member?
Well, I think there's two different answers to that, because in this instance you need to distinguish between the management members of the board and the non-execs, and I think the two require two different qualities. I think the management, it's very simple. A good operational director of a company is one who is absolutely on top of the strategic direction of the company, and specifically of the area of operation for which he or she has responsibility. And what you're looking for there is people who are absolutely fluent in the areas for which they're responsible to the board for the operation of the company. With non-execs, it's a different matter altogether. I think what makes a good non-exec is one who can spot the early warning signs of problems and who has the ability to analyze and articulate them clearly in such a way that the board can respond to them. And if that non-exec can actually help the board to flex and switch, refine its direction and recalibrate before the problem becomes severe, then the non-exec has done a very good job.
In terms of kind of problems arising, how do you structure that communications with founders and let them know of your concerns and how you think it could be rectified? It can often be a challenging role.
I think this is work in progress, and it's a rather sensitive question, because so far, I mean, I've in my life, I've sat on an awful lot of boards, But generally, I've been operational. The other important thing that I bring to this is that actually my core skills are sales and marketing. Although we are a specialist resource use angel investment syndicate, my personal mantra is that if you can't sell, you can't succeed. And I've seen an awful lot of companies with inferior products and inferior services become brand leaders because they know better than their competitors how to sell their inferior products and services to the market. If you've worked that out, you will win. If you haven't worked that out, you will lose. Now, that's incredibly unfashionable, particularly here in the UK. It would be much more clearly understood in America. And so I go on with the specialist syndicate investment into these specialist technology sectors, which are generally filled with highly qualified and very experienced specialists from the energy sectors, from the transport sectors. We invest in sustainable transport, energy in transport, in other words, energy efficiency in transport. With the water, I like water a lot. Water is incredibly important because if we don't get enough water, we're going to die. You know, water is one of the core resource. All of these sectors are dominated by specialists in their utility delivery. None of them understand the world of modern consumer markets, and none of them understand the techniques of modern consumer markets. And so when I say what I've just said to you, if you can't sell it, you can't succeed, they look at me as if I'm a monster from outer space. In the companies where I've started to make a really to take up a really strong position and tried to redirect them, so far it's been quite bruising. I've had to say what I feel they need to do courteously and politely at first. Then I've had to say it a little bit more loudly, and in the cases where I've had to do this, both times I have had to become actually very, very forceful before they've listened to me. And I must admit, I don't like that. I would much rather be able to get them to listen to what I'm saying at a much earlier stage. And so with our latest investment, I've actually gone on the board straight away and the condition of investment was that I took up a responsibility for guiding, as a non-exec, guiding their marketing and sales. And so I've started doing that right from the start, and it is a much, much, much more cooperative and collaborative process. They are terrifically receptive, and the whole process is very friendly. And as a result, it's being much more effective, much more quickly, and much more productive. It's saving them not just a lot of time, it's saving them a lot of money because they were going to get external consultants to do the things for them that I'm doing for free because I'm an investor.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was a very pointed question, which touches on a sensitive spot at the moment, Harry.
Well, you answered it very brilliantly, so not to worry on that. And I'm sorry for touching on the delicacy of it. But in terms of kind of the selling, I'm always intrigued as to the necessity of founders selling. And particularly I spend a lot of time in the SaaS world, where it's commonly recognized that all founders have to be able to sell their product, generally up to about $1 million in ARR. So I'm intrigued as to whether you think founders really do need to sell their product at the very early stages, or can they hire the sales team from the beginning?
I think they're lost if they can't, to be honest. I think if you're dealing with founders who really can't sell, then they're not even going to raise the investment. You know, generally, you're dealing with the if they're founders who can't sell, they're the mad inventors, and that's what they're most interested in. What unfortunately happens is that you get the founders who can sell to a limited extent and have no professional experience of selling. So as selling starts to get more serious, and by this I just mean that they start selling to customers properly, they're not just selling to investors. So right from the beginning, if they don't understand how to build up a pipeline and the concept of lead lag time and the conversion rates and how many people you have to speak to in order to get each stage further in the sales process, and they've got no experience of that, then they're going to struggle. And it's a steep learning curve. It's much better if you get somebody who really does know how to do that.
Absolutely. No, I completely agree with you. I'd love to dive into a quick fire round, though, with you now, Nick. So I say a short statement, and then you give me your immediate thoughts. How does that sound?
Yeah, go on.
So let's start with your favourite investing resource. What did you really kind of study up on using when you were entering the game? Could be a book, blog, newsletter.
No, nothing. Absolutely nothing. That's why everything I've done has been so naive, and I've really learned on the job. No, I mean, I came in with a lot of knowledge about the resource use technologies, which I was most interested in. I've also got an enormous amount of business experience because I've spent all my life working on a variety of different businesses in which I've been privileged to see inside businesses large and small and how they work. So I know an awful lot about, and I have spent a chunk of time in the entrepreneurial space as well. So I had all of that business knowledge, but I was too stupid and too pig-headed to go and read up about investment and how investment works. Belatedly, I came across a book by a man who'd subsequently become a good friend, a good working associate. I'd be pleased if I could consider him a friend, called Simon Ackland. And he wrote a book called Angels, Dragons, and Vultures, which is actually a guide to the entrepreneur rather than to the angel investor. But it works both ways. And I must admit, when I read that, I felt a little bit stupid that I hadn't read it before I'd started.
Not to worry. But what do you then most look for in a co-investor? What gives you reassurance when you see it alongside you on the cap table?
Well, very much. But because of that naivety, Harry, I find myself hugely reassured when we're investing alongside another syndicate that is clearly not a specialist in the way that we are. We're the only ones in the UK who have this narrow vertical niche. So the ones that I really like working alongside are the ones who are really experienced angel investor syndicates and who really know their way round the intricacies of angel investment. Ideally, they're prepared to lead, and we follow on as a co-investor. And so we co-invested with Par Equity in Edinburgh, actually with our only Scottish investment, and they are a fantastic syndicate. We've co-invested with Turquoise in London, who are they're not an angel syndicate. They're more fund management. We like them an awful lot. I mean, they are very, very experienced, and that's great for us because it means I learn a lot. I should also say it would be remiss of me not to mention the fact that a year ago I was joined by my now working partner, a man called Andrew Aldridge, who is in fact a very experienced investment man. He worked for Climate Change Capital, so he not only is an investment specialist, he's actually also an energy specialist. So he's a wonderful addition to the team, He does have the knowledge, so he doesn't need to go through this learning curve that I need.
And then talk to me, Nick. Final quickfire question is, what's the most recent investment from the syndicate and why did you make the investment?
The most recent investment is a domestic energy storage company called PowerVault, which has got a domestic battery product with software controls that allow remote management of it, and you can charge up the battery in your own home in times of low cost electricity, and you can discharge it at times of high cost. That's the simple basic premise of it. The reason why we invested is because at the moment this is a niche product. It's niche because it only really affect people who either have solar panels, PV panels, or who are off the gas grid and use an electricity tariff called Economy 7. So those are very, very tiny sectors. And that, frankly, makes the product... It's a new product category. The product category has never existed before. And the product category isn't particularly interesting in those sectors. The reason why it is potentially a very, very exciting sector is because in 2 or 3 years' time, we all will have smart meters. Smart meters will do something for the first time in the history of energy supplies that has never been possible before. Smart meters will allow the energy suppliers to monitor and control the supply of electricity to your home in real time. And that's what's new. In real time is what's new. They will be able to see what you're doing, and they will be able to monitor it, and they will. They have an obligation to make sure that you're on the cheapest tariff. They will use these products to make sure that you do get the best deal. Otherwise, they'll be punished by Ofgem, the regulator. But much more importantly, we're living now in an energy fragile age. In the UK, I'm just talking about the UK here. This is, but all my remarks apply globally. The energy industry is desperate to try and put that energy fragility right. Domestic energy storage that is controlled by the electricity supplier is a very clever way of doing it. Because at times of crisis, what the electricity supplier will be able to do is aggregate the electricity stored in all of the batteries in their customers' houses, flick a switch, and push the electricity back into the grid. And the really big energy companies, the Scottish and Southern Energies and the Centricas and the so on, have so many customers that aggregating all of their customers' storage will mean that they're putting a lot of electricity back onto the grid when the grid needs it. So this product is going to come of age, and when it comes of age, then PowerVault, I think, will be a very successful business.
Well, Nick, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show today. I'm so grateful to you for giving up the time, and very exciting to hear the incredible road ahead with the syndicate, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much indeed, Harry. It's been a pleasure.
What a refreshingly honest and thought-provoking interview, and a huge hand to Nick there for giving up his time today to appear on the show. And you must check out Green Angel Syndicate. It really is fantastic work that they're doing in the investment in the green energy space. And also, if you love the show today and want to see more from Syndicate Room, simply head over to syndicateroom.com, where you can find a whole host more articles, resources, and podcast episodes. As always, we so appreciate all your support and look very forward to seeing you next week.